You're listening to Consider This on KZYX. My name is Stuart Campbell, and I welcome you to the program. We're on the web at considerthis.us, where you can sign up to receive email updates about future programs. We're also on the KZYX website, and you can get information about future, current, and past programs, and listen to or download podcasts of past shows at both places. You can call us here in the studio a little later on in the program at 707-895-2448. Or you can send your comments or questions at any time to dj@kzyx.org. My returning guest on this program is Marcia Bartuszak, professor of the practice of the graduate program in science writing at MIT and award-winning author of many books, primarily on Einstein and astronomical physics. We'll be talking about her most recent, a revised, updated classic, Einstein's Unfinished Symphony, the story of a gamble, two black holes, and a new age of astronomy, which recounts the search for and now discovery of Einstein's predicted gravitational waves. Marcia Bartuszak, welcome back to Consider This.
It's very nice to be back, Stuart.
So the book chronicles the story of the search for gravitational waves, and this updated edition includes the most recent discoveries of a little less than the last 2.5 years, which we will get into. But the story really begins with Einstein and his predecessors in science. He transformed the scientific worldview of the, 17th and 19th centuries that was largely developed by Isaac Newton. So as background, I'd like to ask you to start out by laying some of the key elements of that earlier worldview of space, time, light forces, et cetera. In other words, I thought we'd start with Newtonian mechanics, which you have in Chapter 2 of the book, and then move on from there.
Well, Isaac Newton gave us that great law of gravity, telling us that there was this attractive force. He was telling, and he gave us an equation which allowed scientists to then predict the motions of the solar system in the heavens. It was a great, outstanding contribution, but there was one thing missing. He couldn't say why it worked like that. He didn't know the origin of gravity. He had the equations. He could tell us how the planets will move, but he couldn't say why. What was the reason behind that? And the reason was he did not yet have the full understanding of space and time. Newton thought that space was just this empty box, but it doesn't really work that way. And it was Einstein's great general theory of relativity, which he introduced in 1915, which finally told us the origin of gravity. Why does gravity work that way? And what he discovered is he did away with Newton's notion of space and time and came up with his own. He realized that space and time are actually melded together. And it's a real physical object. It's hard for us to get our minds around that because we still think of space as just an area that's devoid of matter and it's just there. But Einstein, with his theory of general relativity, described it as an object. Space and time come together to form like a fabric that can be bent and indented and changed. And that's what leads us into this idea of gravitational waves.
I'd like to just flesh it out just a bit more, this kind of the difference between a Newtonian mechanical view of space and time and the Einsteinian one, because as you mentioned, it's kind of hard for us to get our minds wrapped around it. In normal everyday life, we kind of live in a Newtonian world. We treat space like it is this fixed thing, and we treat time like it's a fixed thing. So if you could, I mean, that's kind of the common sense, normal, everyday life that we live, and it's really only in non-typical circumstances where Einstein's theories come to play. So could you just flesh that out for the listeners just a little bit more?
Yeah. We do live in a space where there are low temperatures, low energies, and things don't happen very fast.
Right.
So that under those circumstances, Newton's laws of gravity work just fine for us. We don't need Einstein in our everyday life. Newton worked just fine. And he had this idea that space is a box, and we're just moving within that box. Einstein, with relativity, and this is why it's known as relativity, is that he realized that, no, space is not a box. We all are living within our own space-times. Say that we're standing next to each other. As soon as I start moving away from you, my space and time is different from your space and time. As I start moving away, time starts, according to my watch, time starts getting slower. I'm gaining weight, and my measurements are getting more contracted. Now, this is all, you know, if I'm just walking away at a normal pace, totally unmeasurable and unobservable. But if I start moving away from you at the speed of light, all of those things will be very noticeable. And that's what Einstein brought into play, is he realized that these changes are only observable when we are under unusual circumstances, and that would be traveling at the speed of light or when gravity is very, very strong, like near a neutron star or black hole. Things start being observable under those circumstances. Under our normal life here on Earth, very low temperature when compared to the sun or a quasar, things are very much more Newtonian. Einstein is describing a universe when there are more extremes, intense gravities, and motions approaching the speed of light.
But it does have, and this can, I think, is something people can connect to, it does have one very real impact in our lives, and that's with GPS.
It is. That is, you know, if we didn't know about it, about general relativity, and had sent satellites up to start helping us navigate on Earth, we would have noticed this, and we would have discovered general relativity through that. It turns out that the satellites that are hovering about the Earth and helping us do our navigation of our cars, planes, and boats require relativistic corrections. It turns out that the clocks, general relativity tells us that time out in space goes by more quickly than when we're here on Earth, weighed down by Earth's gravity. Our clocks run slower here on Earth than on the satellites out there in space. And in order to carry out the global positioning and use our Google map directions to take us about in our cars, we need to correct for that. Now, it's very, very tiny. We're talking just millions, trillions of a second corrections per day. But if we didn't carry out those directions, then the global positioning system wouldn't work at all. We have to correct for this relativistic change in time from out in space to here on Earth. So, yes, we wouldn't have GPS without Einstein's theory of relativity, knowing about it and correcting for it.
So let's get just a little bit more history in here between Newtonian mechanics and Einstein. There were some problems in understanding how the forces worked from Newtonian mechanics, which prompted people to postulate this thing called the luminiferous ether, which was the idea until Einstein came along, and so the early part of the 20th century. Could you talk about that just briefly and kind of some of the problems with it and what happened with maybe Michelson-Morley and those experiments, and then we can move from there into Einstein's ideas?
Yeah, the when Maxwell came up with his electromagnetic theory, he came He developed the equations of electromagnetism. He was the one who discovered that the union of electricity and magnetism could be described by this set of equations. And what he noticed was that the electromagnetic waves that he saw within his equations traveled at what was known to be the speed of light. So then he realized that is what light was. Light was actually an electromagnetic wave. He discovered that, and he saw that in his equations. But at the same time, this was the 18th century, you know, when you had a wave, something had to be waving. So it was always assumed that the light wave was an undulation of this, what they called the ether, this unusual matter that somehow filled space uniformly, but that light was transmitted as an undulation in this ether. But that also meant that it should be, if this was happening, that if the Earth was moving through this ether, that the speed of light should change if you are measuring it in one direction or the other with the Earth's movement or against the Earth's movement. It would, if you're with the Earth's movement, then the light will, according to that, be different than if you were measuring the light against the Earth's movement. And that's what the Michelson-Morley experiment. They used this light interferometer to measure the speed of light and see if there was a difference in light, say, from a star or coming with the Earth or against the Earth's movement. And they noticed no change whatsoever. And no one could understand why that was until Einstein developed his special theory of relativity. And then he realized that the speed of light is a constant. That is the one known constant. It does not matter what your particular speed is. The speed of a light is constant for everyone. If I am traveling in a car at 40 miles an hour and you're standing on the side, and I'm racing past you, we will both measure the speed of light the same. And that seems weird, but that's exactly what relativity is telling us, that when people are moving about, they are in, again, you know, relative to one another, they are in their own little bubble of space-time. The one constant is the speed of light. And what changes is when I am looking at you and measuring your watch or your size or your mass, it's going to be different than when I see you by me and we're both at the still together. Length, mass, and time change as soon as there is movement between one another, and the speed of light is constant. So there was no need for this ether to transmit the electromagnetic wave. The electromagnetic wave can travel through empty space. It is its own transmitter in a way. It didn't need this luminiferous ether to be transported through space and time.
So that really kind of turns things on their head. That's one of Einstein's real contributions here, is this shift from thinking of space and time as being fixed constants to the speed of light being the fixed constant. And again, I think in normal everyday thinking, it's a little hard to wrap our heads around that. So maybe
it's
we could...
It's very difficult. It's why there are so many challenges to Einstein's theory, because everyone, we all want to use our common sense approach. In fact, many of our common sense approaches, we think of Aristotelian physics, that an object in motion will always slow down because we live in a world of gravity and friction, and that's what we're used to. If we throw a ball to our dog, the ball will slow down. But if we're out in space and we throw a ball, it will go on and on and on because there's nothing to stop its motion. An object in motion will stay in motion until there is a force against it. And the thing is, because we live on, here on Earth with all these other friction and gravity and everything, it's hard for us to understand the laws of physics that is removed from our environment. And that's why it's so hard, and Einstein especially, because many of the effects aren't seen until things are going very, very fast, near the speed of light. But these effects are seen, like in particle accelerators. They see that electrons or protons that are flying around near the speed of light within a particle accelerator do gain weight, and their time is slowed down. So these effects are seen, but in very, very special circumstances.
I've always thought that the kind of twins paradox illustrates this pretty well. So could you just explain that to continue to try to flesh this idea out a little bit?
Well, the twin paradox takes into account this idea that imagine one twin is safe on Earth while the other goes into a rocket ship and flies off at near the speed of light. As soon as that happens, they are going to start seeing their clocks differ. As we look at the astronaut flying off near the speed of light, we will see that clock going slower and slower and slower. And then it will turn around and say it comes back. Then the astronaut on the rocket will be younger. It will not have experienced as much time as his twin on Earth. And the twin will be older, and the astronaut that went off at the speed of light and came back will be younger.
It's so hard to kind of grasp that. One of the things that I really got, there are a number of things I got out of the book that really kind of clarified things for me, but one is this notion now of space-time. And while we're talking about time being different for different observers and space being different, but I had never really quite seen that the whole of it, the four dimensions, space-time, that still adds up to the same, constant, that while the space changes with speed and gravity and the time might change, the total of the two is still...
Yes, that remains is... I'm trying to find a way to easily describe this, but it was Minkowski, one of Einstein's teachers, who saw that what Einstein did with his theory of special relativity was make time a fourth dimension, so that we have height, width, length, and time. Now, this is hard for us to wrap our heads around because we have three-dimensional brains, and to think of something in a fourth dimension is difficult, but mathematicians do this all the time. And what in relativity, where we see that when we have two people who are, say, moving apart at a constant rate, they will see each other's space different, they'll see each other's time different, but space-time together, they are both experiencing that in the same way.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Consider This on KZYX. I'm your host, Stuart Campbell, and my guest is Marcia Bartuszek, author of Einstein's Unfinished Symphony, The Story of a Gamble, Two Black Holes, and a New Age of Astronomy. You can find out more on the web at considerthis.us or at kzyx.org. So let's move into this idea of gravitational waves, because that's very much what's new and what's exciting and what prompted you to update the book, because there's been some really incredible discoveries over the last 2.5 years. And I was just, in reading the book, I was just amazed. I got to tell you the truth, the technology that's required and the advances in technology in order to have these laser interferometer gravitational wave observatories, LIGO, right? I think it's pronounced LIGO for short, that have been now developed and really only went online with the kinds of sensitivities needed to detect gravitational waves in 2015. If you could start, and another, so I was impressed both with that. I was also impressed with the kind of unwavering, but just the commitment over decades by scientists to keep working on this in the face of even outright opposition to it and very little results, and sometimes results which turned out to not actually be good results. So could you start to talk about that story of the development of this instruments and the theory to detect gravitational waves?
Yeah, this has been the longest venture into Einsteinian experiments. It was the last prediction from Einstein's great theory of general relativity to be proven directly. Some of the first ones were done very early on, right after 1915 when he introduced his theory. He predicted that light would bend by a heavy gravitational field like the sun's, and they measured that in 1919, famous solar eclipse experiment, and that's when Einstein became a public figure, and his name and picture were splashed all over the newspapers, and that's when Einstein became the beloved genius to the public. There was this one prediction that he made that, well, he thought it would never be seen because it's a very, very subtle effect. As I said, he discovered the origin of gravity, that space-time is actually a fabric, and any heavy object like a sun or a star is bending that space-time. And the reason that we orbit and have gravity is that we are circling that space-time warp. We're caught within the warp of space-time, this pit of space-time, and we are circling around it. This is the very origin of gravity, is these indentations in space-time. That is what the gravitational force is. And Einstein, right early on, realized, well, also, since this is this fabric, if this object should move suddenly, if a star should blow up, if two stars are circling around one another, they would create ripples, undulations in this fabric. But in his day and age, the universe was pretty serene, and when he carried out his calculations, he knew that these waves would be very, very faint, so faint it was impossible to measure. And that's where that idea just stood for many decades, until the 1950s, when this very clever physicist and experimentalist named Joseph Weber at the University of Maryland figured out, hey, I can come up with a way to discover a gravity wave. And it was this giant, not giant, but a sizable cylinder of metal. And he figured if a gravity wave went through it, it would subtly expand and contract the metal bar. And with electronic sensors around the bar, it would start ringing like a gong. And he developed some of these bars. They came to be known as Weber bars. And in 1969, he announced he had found a gravitational wave from the center of the Milky Way, possibly a star exploding. And others quickly came to the fore. Throughout the 70s and into the 80s, there were great efforts at many physics laboratories around the world to build these bars and confirm the discovery of gravitational waves. And alas, no one found them. Joseph Weber's waves were never confirmed, and they now believe what he actually saw was just noises within the bar itself, and that he didn't really truly understand that. But at the same time, he was literally the founder of the field of gravitational wave astronomy, because he got others to start thinking about other ideas for capturing waves. And a number of people, most importantly, Rainier Weiss at MIT, came up with a very clever scheme. They decided that if you had a set of masses in the shape of an L, and have those masses be mirrors, and have a laser beam go back and forth between these mirrors, if a gravity went through, they would subtly move as an effect to the gravity wave, and they could measure it. The lasers would be measuring the space between the mirrors, and they would measure it and capture when a gravity wave went through. And Ray Weiss came up with this idea in the late 1960s. He developed a big report in 1972 that is still used to this day. It was a historic document that said how these lasers and mirrors could be set up to act as a detector. 1972, and he started, other people came onto this idea. They started building small sort of tabletop prototypes. But what Ray Weiss realized is they would never, ever be able to actually start finding waves until they built huge interferometers, as they call them, with arms miles long. And he started campaigning in the 1980s to try to build these large observatories. And he teamed up with Caltech, Kip Thorne and Ron Drever, who were physicists there, who were also looking into this method. And they teamed up, and they came up with a plan that came to be known as LIGO, the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory. And they started trying to get funds, and it took a long, long time. It took more than a decade of campaigning, mainly because the rest of the scientific community, when they first heard they were trying to get funds from the National Science Foundation, rose up in a hue and a cry and said, "We can't put money into a gamble. This is a gamble. There's so many other projects that are out there that should have this money." And so they faced great resistance from fellow scientists on this. But they kept at it for more than 10 years, and they finally did, through a special act of Congress, got the funds. The first initial funds were in the order of $300 million, which allowed them in the 1990s to construct these two detectors, one in Louisiana and the other in Washington State. And they got them going in 2001. They came into operation. They knew, and this was Ray Weiss's strategy, is that they knew that they weren't going to see something right away, because they needed to build big to check out the system and understand it and learn from it. And they did learn. And they got, over the years, they got better lasers, more powerful lasers. They got better technology for suppressing any interfering noises. And they developed what they called advanced LIGO. And they were on an engineering run in 2015 doing their final check on the new equipment. And even before they started their observing run, they found their first wave on September 14th, 2015. That was the first direct bona fide gravitational wave ever detected. And it has been confirmed now several times over. They've had many more signals. That it was a struggle. I don't think it's something that could be done today. They were very fortunate in starting this in an environment where Congress was willing to give them the gamble to build these observatories, even though there was no guarantee that they would see anything. In today's atmosphere, I don't think this could have happened.
Right. The technology, as I said, just is impressive. One of the things that struck me about the book that I had not really seen clearly, so I'd like you to talk about it and relate that to these gravitational waves are very difficult to detect. The measurement of them is you're measuring something, the effects of which are very, very small. And you mentioned in passing these detectors have to filter out an awful lot of other things, just even sounds outside the building or earthquakes or all this other kind of stuff. And the laser technology impressed me. The mirror technology impressed me. Maybe you could talk about that. And then also another key distinction that I had not seen is that there's a real difference between electromagnetic waves and gravity waves. So if you could distinguish those two.
These two detectors, and there's also another one active in Italy called Virgo. These detectors are the most sensitive measuring devices on Earth. They are amazing. Now, the first thing I have to tell you is, why are they in an L shape? And I should mention that a gravitational wave has a very distinctive effect on space-time. As the gravity wave is traveling, it's not traveling through space. It is an undulation in space-time. As it travels along, it is literally expanding and contracting space-time, expanding and contracting like an accordion in play. But it also does this differently in two different directions. As a gravity wave is coming down on space-time, it is expanding space-time in one direction, say north-south, while contracting it in the other direction, orthogonal to it, east-west. And then a thousandth of a second later, this reverses. So there's this constant back-and-forth motion, contracting and expanding, but different ways in different directions. That is the unique, very unique signature of a gravitational wave. And that is why each of these observatories is in an L shape. While one arm is contracting, the other is expanding, and then a thousandth of a second later, it reverses. So there's this contraction, expansion. That's the unique signature of a gravity wave. That is what these observatories are watching, looking for, that unique signature. And they also, here in the United States, they built two because to help them distinguish a gravity wave from all of these other interfering noises. Their first and foremost requirement for saying something is a gravitational wave is it has to be seen at both observatories within the speed of light distance, which is, I think, 0.2 seconds difference between Washington and Louisiana. They have to be seeing the wave nearly simultaneously so that they know that it wasn't something else like an earthquake or a lightning bolt or radio interference. They have sensors all over the landscape around the detectors. They keep watch on earthquakes coming from around the world because they actually get disturbed by that. There can be an earthquake in Japan, and they will feel that motion and it will affect the observatory. They sometimes even have to lock it down and turn it off until the earthquake waves pass by. Even if they're very, very minor waves, they notice that. They notice the activity, people just walking around and doing their day-by-day activity around the sites of the detectors. Lightning bolts around the world can affect them. Trucks passing by. Even the waves hitting the Gulf Coast is detected by these detectors. They can feel those forces of the waves hitting the Gulf Coast there in Louisiana. It's an amazing detector, but they have all these sensors, and so they can subtract out that noise from the other signals. An amazing set of software and computer gauges to keep track of all these other noises. And when all of that is subtracted out and a gravity wave does hit both detectors, they can detect a motion that is 1,000 times smaller than an atomic particle. That's how amazing this instrument is, how delicate and subtle they can find such a subtle difference. Gravity waves are a very difficult thing to detect. There can be a billion light years away two black holes colliding, and the waves right near the collision have a tremendous effect. They are strong enough to tear apart planets and moons. But as they spread out in all direction, and by the time they reach Earth, the wave is very, very tiny, very, very small. The expansions and contractions of space-time are extremely tiny. That's why Einstein thought they'd never be detected. But the fact that these LIGO scientists were able to develop instruments that could detect something so tiny and yet follow exactly match the predictions of Einstein's theory, an amazing match of theory to experimental science. It's an amazing technological feat. They truly did deserve. They just recently received the Nobel Prize in Physics. Ray Weiss, Kip Thorne, and Barry Barish, who was the manager who finally got the LIGO detectors built and running. They won the Nobel Prize in Physics, and very deservedly, though they all always make it known that they were just part of a extremely large enterprise. The LIGO-Virgo collaboration involves more than 1,000 scientists. The first paper had more than 1,000 authors because each and every one of those people contributed to the production of these two detectors in building them, in running them, in establishing the simulations of matching Einstein's theory to the signals that are received. All of this is such a theoretical and experimental enterprise of an amazing enterprise.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Consider This on KZYX. I'm your host, Stuart Campbell. My guest is Marsha Bartushak, author of Einstein's Unfinished Symphony, The Story of a Gamble, Two Black Holes, and a New Age of Astronomy. I'm going to take just a brief break here. As people have heard from us, we're in the midst of a year-end pitch for funding for the radio station. This is not a regular pledge drive. We're just trying on every program to at least remind people that you can make a year-end contribution, tax-deductible contribution to this radio station to keep us operating, to keep bringing this kind of programming to you, which we don't get this kind of long format programming really kind of anywhere but in local public community radio, as well as being here for you when we are needed for emergencies like the fires that we had up here in Northern California. We received lots of accolades for our coverage of that. We're really working hard as well to expand our news coverage and working on some other initiatives that you'll be hearing about and that we'll be getting on our airwaves in the upcoming days. We're really trying to expand our community engagement. We are a community radio station. We really are starting to think of ourselves more as a hub, as a central location for all things going on in this county. And you can make a tax-deductible donation to us by either going on the web at kzyx.org or giving us a call during business hours at 895-2324 and make your end-of-the-year pledge of support so that it can get on your taxes for this year. So we really invite you to do that, and I really encourage and hope that you will do that. Okay, so let's we'll get to the punchline now here. You mentioned already that in 2015 they had their first detection while they weren't even quite ready to do it. I mean, the story of that is interesting. I don't know that we need to take the time for it, but there were a number of different circumstances that were just really kind of serendipitous. Had they not happened, they wouldn't even have noticed that. But there have been
there were several ways that they might have shut down the interferometer right before they saw the signal, but fortunately they didn't. It could have not happened.
Right. And there have now been five detections in a little over 2 years now. The first four were of black hole incidents, and then this most recent one was neutron stars. But I think we should start with black holes, talk a little bit about black holes and why they were maybe some of the first detections, because they really do emit some very powerful gravity waves.
Yes, in fact, that was the reason they saw the black holes first, because if you have two very massive black holes, in fact, the first signal, they were both roughly each 30 solar masses carrying the weight of 30 suns in each. And when they collided, it was the biggest, most energetic effect ever registered by astronomers. Because when those two black holes collided, forming a new black hole, it lost some of the mass totally. You know, the old equation, E equals mc squared. Two solar masses were totally converted into energy, and that was released in the form of these gravitational waves. That was more energy, 50 times more energy than all the stars in the universe were radiating at that moment. All the stars in more than 100 billion galaxies were radiating at that moment. That then, this occurred 1.3 billion years ago, and then it took that long for the wave to finally move and disperse throughout the universe until we saw a very little minor part of it. Like I said, it moved the mirrors within the interferometer just a thousandth the size of a proton. But the look of the wave was exactly as predicted from Einstein's equations, which is, when you think about it, astounding that his equations could predict something, an event that he wasn't even aware of. He died before we knew that such things as black holes and neutron stars even existed in the universe. And there's a reason that it took that long, because it is only the most violent events in the universe that create gravitational waves strong enough to travel through the universe and actually be detected. You need very, very compact objects that release tremendous amounts of gravity waves. Space-time is actually very rigid. It's very hard to get it moving. Very hard to create these ripples. It is only the most powerful events in the universe. stars blowing up or black holes and neutron stars colliding, which allow the gravity waves to be created that we can eventually detect. So, yes, the black hole events are the most powerful because they're the most compact and massive objects that can collide together to create these events. But finally, last August, we had two neutron stars. A neutron star is the remnant of an old star. It is the former core that has collapsed tightly into a bound state of neutrons. It's like a gigantic atomic nucleus, the size of a city. It's just about 10 or 12 miles wide. And when these two objects collided, it created a somewhat weaker, because the objects have less mass, they put out a slightly weaker gravitational flood of gravitational waves. So that's why it took a little longer. LIGO had to increase its sensitivity to find these waves. But the greatest thing about neutron stars colliding is the signal is much longer. The signal that they saw from the colliding black holes lasted maybe 2 seconds, often less than that, sometimes just tenths of a second. The neutron star signal went on for more than 50 seconds. They had this great, rich signal to examine, and they're still studying it to this day. And that's going to be their bread and butter over time as they increase the sensitivity of their instrument. It's more likely that they'll be seeing these neutron star collisions weekly or maybe even daily once they get their sensitivities up.
Well, the other thing about the neutron star collision that you talk about in the book is that's distinct from the black holes. The black holes generate just gravitational waves. These neutron star collisions generate both gravitational waves and electromagnetic waves so that we can both get the detection on these LIGO systems, but also other typical astronomical systems. So there's a much richer confirmation.
Oh, very much. This is what they have been striving for, to have what they call multi-messenger astronomy, that you're not getting just the electromagnetic waves, which is the primary wave we've been studying the universe. Now they have both the electromagnetic waves in light, infrared, gamma rays, X-rays, and also the gravitational wave. And each of them say something different about the event. It's as we only had a telescope that saw blue light, and now suddenly we can see yellow and red and orange and green. It is going to be this wonderful way of looking at an event in many different ways. Electromagnetic waves tell us something about how much the object weighs, how old it is, what it's composed of. But what gravitational waves tell us is how the object moves and twirls and its motions in space. It enables us to see something which is invisible to us. We can't see black holes. They are dark. We only see them through their effect on other matter around them. Neutron stars are too tiny for us to see directly. We notice the pulses coming from them as they spin. We call them pulsars because they're sending out these regular blips of electromagnetic energy, but we can't see them directly. But the gravitational waves are a direct signal from these very tiny objects that we can't see visibly. So we're seeing all of this wonderful information about their emotions, about their behavior, and also what they're composed of, how old they are, what they're made of, all of this coming from this combined information of both the electromagnetics and the gravity wave. And that was the very first time last August where they were able to see both the gravitational wave signal, where they alerted astronomers to right away. As soon as they got the signal, the astronomers were alerted at observatories and people who are have the space satellites, and very quickly they saw infrared visible. The Hubble Space Telescope was able to observe the visible light. X-rays and gamma rays, they're now seeing the remnant radio signal months afterward of the radio waves coming from the matter around the neutron star, these colliding neutron stars glowing in radio waves. It's an amazing a collaboration between the astronomical community and the gravitational wave community.
We're getting close to the end, but I'm going to try to invite some listeners. If we got, maybe we can get a call or two in here. If you've got a question for Marsha Bartuszak about gravity waves or black holes, any of this kind of stuff, give us a call at 895-2448. And while we're seeing somebody might want to call, another point I want to just make, these sightings now are really absolute confirmation in a new way of Einstein's relativity, and also black holes. This is direct confirmation of the existence of black holes.
Yes, before this, there was only circumstantial evidence about black holes. X-ray astronomers could see a lot of X-rays coming out of these accretion disks, which appeared to be swirling around an invisible object in the center. And from the mechanics and the orbitals, it had to be a black hole that was where this matter was spiraling into a black hole, and as it was being speeded up, it would before it was swallowed by the black hole, we would see the X-rays and the radio waves and the visible light coming from these swirls of matter. But it was only circumstantial evidence that it was a black hole. Gravity waves, when these two black holes are colliding, there is a unique signature only be possible from Einstein's equations, that they were black holes. These gravity waves are a direct signal from the black holes themselves. It was the first direct evidence that black holes exist.
Marsha, I'm going to interrupt you just a second. I do have a call. I'd like to get at least one caller on here, if you don't mind.
No.
Hi there. You're on the air. May I have your first name, please?
First name is Steve.
Hey, Steve. Go ahead.
My question is, how do the gravity waves actually affect the particles? And also, how does this relate to Einstein's cosmological constant backup theory?
Okay, great. Thanks, Steve.
Yes, they primarily, their biggest effect is on expanding and contracting space-time. There is a lesser effect on matter. An object is squeezed and compressed a little less than space-time itself. As an example, if you were right next to two black holes colliding and you were 6 feet tall, it would squeeze and compress you 1,000 times a second by about half a foot. And space-time itself, the expansion and contraction would be much larger than that. So it does affect matter, but on a lesser degree.
Okay. Maybe if somebody else wants to try to give us a call, we'll see if we can squeeze you in. So I'll let you finish up on these detections now. This is really the forefront of kind of pure science, and it's, a final confirmation. We didn't need it, perhaps, but a direct confirmation of Einstein's theory of relativity.
And what's so amazing is that Ray Weiss once said that here is a signal that, you know, comes from a billion light years away, and yet it follows Einstein's theory to the letter. So far, it has not fallen apart. There may be a time when we will start seeing cracks within general relativity, and it will have to be, you know, revised, just the way Einstein revised and amended Newton's laws of gravity. there may come a time where Einstein has to be amended, but even under this extreme experience of two black holes colliding, Einstein's theory holds up right to its prediction, which is amazing, absolutely amazing, that he could come up with a theory a century, more than a century ago, that holds up under these conditions that he could not himself even imagine.
Okay, we're down to the end of the hour, Marcia. I want to express my appreciation for you being on the show. I'll remind people they're listening to Consider This. My guest is Marcia Bartuszak, author of Einstein's Unfinished Symphony. Marcia, I want to give you just a last opportunity to say anything you'd like to say in closing.
Well, it was a delight to talk with you, Stuart, and I enjoyed it. And to me, this entire enterprise, which did take decades to fulfillment, I'm hoping that the public comes to understand that scientific discoveries are not, you know, made overnight, that we must have support for scientists to follow through on ideas that they sometimes take time and effort and patience to come to fruition. But now, because of this, we are going to learn more about the universe. Even possibly gravitational waves are the one signal that we can, with future detectors out in space, possibly get the signal from the very creation of the Big Bang itself. It will take us back to our creation. This is going to be an amazing technology that in future years, we are at the level of Galileo's telescope, and it will do amazing things once it advances, and new versions and new generations of these gravitational wave telescopes. It's going to be amazing when they reach the level of the Hubble Space Telescope.
It's quite a story. Once again, Marcia Bartuszak. The book is Einstein's Unfinished Symphony. Thanks once again. Really appreciate you being on the program.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.